Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. During the 2012 presidential election cycle, the GOP primary debates were criticized for being overcrowded and shallow. The field is even more crowded for the 2016 Republican primary debates. Today, we look at proposals to trim the field just to fit on the stage, let alone hold viewers' attention. Joining us now is political reporter Eli Stokols. Welcome, Eli.
Hey, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
You wrote earlier this week that a broad consensus is taking hold among GOP party officials that the debates shouldn't include more than a dozen candidates. What's the magic in a dozen or in any number for that matter?
Well, you know, this is still very unsettled. And the RNC folks insist that the, you know, first debate, which is sponsored by Fox News, it'll be up to Fox News to decide. You know, nobody really wants to say, hey, we're making this decision and you know, direct your angry emails and phone calls this way. The RNC meetings in Phoenix that I was at last week were really interesting because everyone there was talking about this subject, and yet no one really wanted to talk a lot on the record, but you know, you did get that sense that there are folks that say, well, you know, last time around, there were the most that we've ever had in a debate was 10. So it's hard to imagine in a field this wide that there would be fewer than that. And they also, you know, talked about 12. And while the official RNC spokespeople and the chairman and those types of folks do not want to say anything publicly about a cap, imposing a cap, you know, you can read between the lines when they said things like, you know, once we get past a certain number of candidates on the stage, 12, 11, 12, 13, somewhere in there, it just doesn't become worth it to any of the candidates to participate because there just isn't enough time for them to share. If you have 12 candidates, you know, in a 90-minute debate as it is, they're each going to get probably less than 5 minutes cumulative, you know, speaking time throughout the entire debate. You know, their commercials, questions have to be read, et cetera, et cetera. So I think there will be a lot of attention around it. And I think what Fox and the RNC are grappling with is with these first debates when the field really could be as many as 18 or 19 people. You know, do you cap it at 12? Do you just deal with those headaches from, you know, people like, oh, I don't know, Bobby Jindal or Rick Santorum or potentially Ben Carson or Carly Fiorina, folks who for other reasons might, you know, cause more of a stir if they were to be left out. Do you want to deal with that? Or do you want to just say, you know what, let's do a two-hour debate. Let's let everybody jump into the pool and work itself out from there. The sense is that the top-tier campaigns and the candidates who, you know, they want to participate may say, look, we're not going to participate if all we get is, you know, 3.5 minutes.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the upcoming GOP presidential primary debates. They will begin in Cleveland in August. The question is, who gets to be on the stage? My guest right now is Eli Stokols. He's a reporter for Politico and has been covering the topic. What about you, listeners? What do you think? Should they leave it as is, 18, 19, 16, 17 candidates on the stage at once? What are your preferences? 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Now, you mentioned, Eli, the headaches of leaving out people like Bobby Jindal or Carly Fiorina or Ben Carson. You didn't mention someone like John Kasich, who's Jindal is governor of a state and is polling very low right now, almost, you know, not even relevant in the polling at this point. There's a lot of concern about leaving out the governor of Ohio.
Yeah, I mean, it's Ohio. The debate will be in Ohio. I mean, you know, there are no good solutions here if there are indeed 18 and 19 candidates and there are 12 spots on stage. We don't know that that'll be the case, but chances are it'll be somewhere in that neighborhood. And, you know, the RNC and the networks, Fox News for this first debate, are really trying to come up with a criteria that is clear and maybe more simple than, you know, a lot of folks are trying to find some secret formula, mm-hmm. and I don't know that there really is one. And we may wind up with them just saying, you know what, we're going to throw out the polls, and we're going to make it all about money. And you've got to demonstrate that you've got this much of a financial commitment to be there. And that may weed out a few of the candidates. And that may make it tough for a John Kasich, perhaps, or for other candidates. You know, that may not be a great way to go, though, because then let's say Donald Trump runs for president. I don't think anybody at the RNC is interested in, you know, having Donald Trump get as much time as Scott Walker, Marco Rubio, Jeb Bush, and others. But, you know, Donald Trump can write a check. And put himself on that debate stage. So what that criteria is really the tricky part. And, you know, the RNC folks, while they don't want to talk about, oh, there's a cap, there's the number, the magic number is 12, they don't want to talk about that, and they acknowledge that, you know, look, this is an ongoing conversation. They will say how hard it is, and, you know, they equated it to trying to split an atom. They just said this has never been done before, and, you know, if it were simple and there was an easy answer out there to be had, we'd have found it and told you about it already. So it's quite the conundrum for them.
Mm-hmm. The GOP sanctioned just 9 debates this time around. That's about half as many as 4 years ago when there were 20. Why the change?
Well, I think they looked at the process 4 years ago and they saw, I mean, we got into September and October of 2011, and there were debates. There were a couple debates a week. There were back-to-back debates on, like, you know, within 48 hours up in New Hampshire at one point. And I think it was just too volatile for the field and the polling. And, you know, you may remember there, you know, every candidate seemed to have a moment. Herman Cain had a moment. Rick Perry had a moment in the debate where he just couldn't remember what he was saying and has really never been taken seriously as a presidential candidate since then. So they are trying, I think, to space these out and to limit the number of them so that the debates are substantive, that there's not debate overload, and that the race can kind of, you know, there can be a debate and then the race can kind of settle and people can sort of, you know, voters can weigh in and pollsters can take a look and say and figure out, you know, who did well, who didn't do well, and what that means to the race. And maybe just not have quite as much commotion and not as much of a roller coaster as there was in 2012. I think that's one of the main things they're looking to avoid.
When are the networks supposed to release their criteria for the debates? Is it network by network? So we're just going to get what Fox's criteria are before the August debate in Cleveland?
That's right. And then CNN is doing the second debate in Los Angeles at the Reagan Library. CNBC is doing the third debate, which is going to be somewhere in Colorado in October. You know, so it's up to all of them to sort of figure it out. And sometimes these questions are also, most of the time, they are logistical. In Cleveland, we understand the debate's most likely going to be at the Quicken Loans Arena, where the Cavaliers play. So, you know, I don't know if there are going to be 15,000 people in the seats, but they are, you know, they conceivably would have space and could build a stage there that could accommodate, you know, 19 or 20 candidates if they needed to. But there will be other venues where, you know, the venues pay or the network pays, and they say, well, we can only fit 8 people here. And those kinds of considerations, while they may mean less to the people watching at home and the people who really are plugged into politics and who will be charged up if the candidate they like doesn't make the cut of a certain debate. You know, those are real considerations for the networks that are giving away basically a lot of airtime and spending a lot of money to produce these debates, trying to come up with something that looks good, put it in an interesting place. The party has an interest in that also, in putting this in places where the electorate and the people in that area will be you know, gives the party an opportunity to do outreach to them. So there are all kinds of considerations in each one of these debates in terms of setting it up, setting the rules, the parameters. But yeah, at the end of the day, each network releases the information to the candidates and to the public as to, okay, here's how many we're going to take. Here's how you qualify. Here's what we're looking for. They will release that when they figure it out. The RNC has asked them to do it, you know, as soon as they have it figured out. But again, It's not an easy equation to solve.
I read, I think it was in the Washington Post, sort of, I think it was back in March during March Madness, a tongue-in-cheek suggestion that they set it up like the NCAA brackets. And
wouldn't that be fun?
Well, you know, I got to tell you, the longer I read the article, the more I thought, this might be actually pretty interesting.
Yeah.
Because one of the criticisms of the last round back in 2012 was the shallowness of the debates, that you had them all up on stage, but you never really could get very deep. And, you had the Rick Perry moments that we'll listen to later on in the program when he forgot the three things, but other than that, it didn't go very deep.
And I think that's just kind of the nature of debates when it's a big primary debate. Maybe that's why they had to have 20 of them last time around. But it doesn't offer a ton of time to get too deep beneath the surface, and that's unfortunate. It might be more interesting, especially, they'll never do it, but if you had this sort of March Madness debate and you seeded all these candidates based on fundraising, there would be potentially a lot of upsets because, say you seated John Kasich 18th and you seated Scott Walker first, I think a lot of people would look at that debate as pretty even, right? Scott Walker may have more buzz, he may have more staff, he may have more fundraising, he may have national support that John Kasich doesn't have, but if you put him on stage mano a mano and they're just going at it for an hour and a half, those are two very interesting and substantive people with, a lot of different policy positions to distinguish. So, the reason they're not going to do that is because of the unlikeliness of ever seeing it, a final, four or final two that looks like that. But for viewership and perhaps for people that get, more substantive information, whether that's what people want or not, that might be a better way to go. It'd be fun to see a bunch of political junkies printing out brackets come August.
That's for sure. The issues of race and gender have been raised. Carly Fiorina, only woman. Ben Carson, the only black so far among the nationally known entrants. But RNC spokesman Sean Spicer said those can't be part of the criteria. So, in other words, because they haven't held public office before, they happen to be. But that can't be part of the criteria to keep them in the debates. So the RNC has given them some parameters, right?
Yeah, but I mean, it's all about. In politics, they always talk about optics and what it looks like to people.
Mm-hmm.
There's that element to both of this. For the network, the RNC, they could never come out and say, we're going to make sure that, here's the criteria, but whatever. Carly and Ben can come in because we need them to showcase diversity. They would never say that outwardly, but that doesn't mean it's not true. And it doesn't mean that on some level, as they're having these conversations, they are talking about the nightmare scenario in terms of the optics. Mm-hmm. If the presidential field that they put up on that stage doesn't include the only woman candidate, doesn't include the only African-American candidate, because then, look, there's a party that is desperate to show itself to be more than just a collection of old white men. They do not want to have, 12 white men on that stage. So, they can say that's not the criteria, and I'm certain that it won't be any part of the official criteria. But I think one of the things they're working toward is making sure that, at least in those initial debates, that there's some diversity represented. And again, it's just how do you do it and how do you get there, short of just saying, okay, everybody can be in the first debate, and you each get 3 minutes.
Well, Eli Stokols, thanks for joining us today to talk about it.
Happy to. It's an interesting topic and should be interesting to see what they come up with.
That's Eli Stokols. He's a reporter for Politico. Coming up, two political scientists will join us to discuss not only the strategy of deciding who the field will be in the debates, but the strategies of the debaters when the time comes. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We've been talking about the prospect of a very crowded Republican primary season, which means another crowded debate stage. Nine debates have already been sanctioned by the Republican National Committee. Three more may be added later on. But it's up to the networks airing the debates to decide the criteria for participation. We're going to talk about that and more, and strategy. Joining us by phone is author and George Washington University political scientist John Sides. He's co-author of the book The Gamble, Choice and Chance in the 2012 Presidential Election. Welcome to the show.
Thanks very much for having me.
And in the studio, Ohio State University political scientist Paul Beck. Welcome back.
Good to be here.
So let's start with you, John Sides, and Paul, chime in. Do debates matter anymore?
I mean, I think that in the primary and in the general election, you can certainly see that sometimes debates can move the polls. That happened in the primary in 2012 at several points. That happened after the first debate in the general election. But moving the polls is not the same thing as determining the winner. And it's very rare for debates actually to, you know, change the race such that the underdog becomes the front runner and vice versa. And in the primary in particular, I think it's very hard for debate performance alone to really be a significant factor. I mean, what sustains and nourishes campaigns in a long primary season is not, you know, a couple of good lines in a debate. You know, you really have to have broader support in the party network and a variety of other resources. And I don't think debates themselves are really going to be the key for any of these candidates.
Paul Beck?
Yeah, I agree with John. I think that debates can matter. They may matter more in primaries than they do in the general election because the candidates are just better known in the general election. Primaries or primary debates give opportunities to candidates who haven't been front runners necessarily to score some points. I think that's particularly true early on. And the thing that we're seeing, of course, shaping up in 2015 is that you have all of these candidates who are kind of elbowing one another for space on the stage. By the time we get to February and March, there won't be many candidates there. There'll be some, obviously, but it's the sorting out process that's going to take place in 2015 that will matter. And voters really don't know a lot about most of these candidates. And for Republican voters, it's kind of hard to differentiate among a large cast of Republicans. And so debate performance can help. But I think John is right that in the end, there are many other factors that are important as well.
Who actually watches the debates now, John Sides?
In a primary election?
Yeah.
It's a pretty small group of people, to be sure. And they're people who are obviously extremely interested in politics. It doesn't mean that they've made up their mind about which candidate they're going to support, particularly for the reasons that Paul said. You know, it's a large number of candidates that are unfamiliar to many voters. But it's a small group. So I think the more important question really in terms of the impact of a debate, if it's going to move the polls at all, is not so much who watches the debate itself, but it's the media coverage that the debate creates. And so, you know, I think even in general elections, you can sometimes see that it's the way the media amplifies a particular narrative out of a debate that actually becomes the more influential thing. So what I would be interested to see is during these primary debates, is there a particular way in which the debate is being framed and covered by the news? And if so, you know, that's what you might see ultimately influencing more people.
Paul Beck, does it matter if it's just insiders? I mean, so it's people, more people are following the media coverage of it later.
Yes, that's correct. I think the other thing maybe to emphasize, and Eli didn't talk about this when he was on earlier, and John and I haven't talked about it either, is the particular format for the debates. These are really not debates.
Right.
Certainly not with 12 people on the stage, if that's what the maximum is going to be. And so you have to think about the individual candidates and which ones are advantaged by being able to use sound bites in the little bit of time that they have to differentiate themselves from the other people who are on the stage and to maybe put the other people on the defensive. And there are people, I think of Ted Cruz, for instance, who is very good at sound bites and was a debater, a champion debater in college. He may have an advantage over somebody else who is maybe more thoughtful, who takes time to develop points that he or she will not have during this format. So the format will be important. Will they be answering questions from the person who is the convener or the moderator of the debate, or will, on the other hand, they be just given a certain amount of time to say their own thing? I don't think we know that yet, and that right. format hasn't been determined.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. If you have a question or comment, want to join the conversation about presidential primary debates, in this case, we're talking about in particular the GOP presidential primary debates that will begin in August in Cleveland. Give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org as well. You know, the format, you know, John Sides, we all agree, they're not really debates anymore. And I was thinking about Ted Cruz. He was a champion collegiate debater. And at the collegiate level, debating is actually very developed, and they do develop more. He is also good at sound bites, though. But they don't really go into it. John Sides, when they're preparing for debates, they don't go into it as if this is a classical debate. They're preparing for what they know is going to be there.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, the challenge in this sense is if you have 10 or 12 people on the stage, you know, how do you stand out?
In a good way.
Yeah, exactly. And the particular challenge here, exactly. The particular challenge is for the underdog candidates, right? And so I think Ted Cruz is a good example. No one thinks of him as a top-tier candidate, right, for the presidential mm-hmm. nomination. And so when you're in that sort of second tier of candidates, you have to figure out a way to make an impression. And I think if you look at 2012, you can see several cases of where, you know, underdog candidates were successful in doing that. And perhaps the best story there is Newt Gingrich in the debates immediately prior to the South Carolina primary, mm-hmm. Where he let loose with a couple of responses to some questions from moderators. And these were also debates in which audience reaction was allowed. And so you had a lot of whooping and hollering and clapping in reaction to that. And I think that probably gives the impression that, you know, these one-liners were successful and therefore, you know, newsworthy. But again, like that's what you need to do as an underdog. But again, like, but what are you going to be able to get from that? Well, in Gingrich's case, and the same thing was true in the fall of 2011, you know, you get a couple of good news cycles, you get a bump in your poll numbers, you happen to win one primary, but that was a pretty short-lived thing. And one analogy you can think about here, perhaps, is that to some extent, the news coverage and the polling boost you get in the wake of a good debate is kind of like a sugar high, but it's not really going to sustain a candidacy through the long slog of the primaries and caucuses. And that's where these underdog candidates are really facing a disadvantage. I mean, the debate might help them for a temporary period of time, but it's not probably enough to actually propel them to the nomination.
A strategist for Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal referred to the 2012 debates as something many saw as road bumps on the way to Romney's coronation, and that isn't the case this time. He said the challenge for the GOP is to get exposure to good candidates. What do you make of that, Paul Beck?
Well, I think if you make the comparison with 2012, Romney was sort of like the Energizer Bunny. Mm-hmm. He just kind of kept on rolling along. He had plenty of resources. It wasn't just a sugar mm-hmm. high. The others kind of rose and fell over time, and there was Romney still. I don't see 2016 for the Republicans looking quite like that. We thought maybe going in that Jeb Bush would be the Romney of 2016. It doesn't appear that that's going to be the case. I mean, he still may be the front runner, if there is a front runner, but he's not a front runner with much of a lead. And other candidates have been able to raise considerable resources as well, a lot of money flowing into their campaigns. And so it may be more of a scramble than it was back in 2012. And, of course, that remains to be seen, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. John Sides?
I think if you go into the fall and you have no sort of clear front runner, and you have maybe Walker or Bush or maybe Rubio or even another candidate that we haven't thought about yet sort mm-hmm. of in that first tier of candidates, then I think the incentives in the debate really is about, it's about not making a mistake. At that point, the debate's really only going to hurt you. And I don't think it's probably not going to propel you to the front of the pack, but it could definitely be a challenge. And so this is where I think the front-running candidates don't have the faith that the underdogs do, because they're basically there to play defense, and the underdogs really are there to try to score points.
So speaking of not making a mistake, what works and what doesn't and whether any of it matters. Ask former Texas Governor Rick Perry. It mattered to him in 2011 during the 11th debate at Oakland University in Rochester, Michigan.
It's three agencies of government when I get there that are gone. Commerce, education, and the what's the third one there? Let's see.
That still makes me cringe. I feel badly for him. John Sides, what, you know, that was, is that a good example or is it an unfair example of how it hurt him?
By that point in his campaign, he had basically experienced almost all the decline that he was going to experience. If you look at his poll numbers, I mean, so in some sense, that was the capstone on the challenges that Perry had faced. It was not the cause of the challenges that he faced. It certainly didn't help him. It didn't, you know, enable him to turn anything around. But it's exactly the – so it, in some sense, it wasn't consequential. But if you want an example of the kind of mistake you don't want to make in a debate, that's a good example.
Yeah. I mean, but it's – I think the reason why it probably makes me cringe is I can relate to it. Paul Beck.
I can relate to it. You know, the other thing to say, thinking about these debates, and John has talked about the top tier candidates, and there will be a set of people who look in the polls as if they are among the circle of front runners, even if there is no single front runner. The underdogs will be taking aim at them, trying to knock one of them off, and of course trying to differentiate themselves from the other underdogs. And that's always interesting to watch. They were taking aim on Romney often in, in 2012. Will they be taking aim on Bush, at Bush in 2016? They'll all be taking aim at Clinton and Obama, of course. But that's not going to differentiate them. What's going to differentiate them is being able to score points on one of the front runners and appear to be in this pack of underdogs, somebody who's of real substance.
What does that matter? That wasn't a signature of the 2012 debate history, that they weren't focusing on the Democratic opponent, Obama, of course. They were tearing each other down, and that's going to be the same thing. John Sides?
It happens, and it's inevitable. You know, Hillary Clinton will face a little bit of that herself. If a couple of other Democratic candidates, you know, eventually get into the race and mount a serious campaign. At the end of the day, it's not quite clear what difference it makes. I mean, I seem to be saying that a lot, but it's true. I mean, the divisions that you might see within the party in a particular primary tend to go away when it's time for the general election. And all the Republicans, you know, for the most part, will get on board with whoever the nominee is. And so some of that infighting, you know, is really a temporary phenomenon, and it's going to be forgotten by the time you get to November 2016. I mean, I think the only thing that you're really concerned about is whether there's going to be some real revelation of lasting significance that's going to emerge from these debates that will actually sort of stick with the nominee for the rest of the campaign. And again, I don't think that's a likely scenario by any stretch, but I guess that's in some sense what the RNC would like to avoid and why it wants to stage manage these debates a little bit more than perhaps it did in 2011.
Paul Beck?
Well, it may be useful to think about the debates as having two phases. There's a phase over the course of 2015 when there really is not much else going on that's going to be visible to voters. And then beginning in February of 2016, there are going to be caucuses and primaries. So we'll have results. And the results, I think, become more the drivers than the debates, whereas early on, the debates are sort of all we have, aside from fundraising and those kinds of things. And fundraising is important. We're in a stage in 2015 of what John and others who've written on this call the invisible primary, where they are trying to line up support, endorsements, money, and the like. And that, of course, is something that comes into play later on in 2016.
Chris in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Chris.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I agree with your previous discussion about they really aren't debates, but I'm wondering if maybe a way to get around so many candidates on stage at one time would be to not call it a debate, maybe, I don't know, a meet and greet or something.
A round robin.
Right, where you just say, hi, my name's Mary, and this is what I believe, and even if they had like two specific topics they had to talk about, maybe the economy or something, but they could just sort of, at least people would kind of get to know them a little bit better.
The best analogy I heard was from Dan Schnur, who's a longtime politico and teacher of politics in California, and he said it's going to be more like a spelling bee. You know, everybody gets up to say their shtick at the microphone, and then you know it sits back down, and you hope you're the person that when you get up and say your shtick, you don't mess it up.
You don't forget how to spell the word. Thanks a lot, Chris. You know, are we kind of kidding ourselves? Why do we continue to call them debates, Paul Beck? Is it, do we just like the sound of that?
We should. I guess the term caught on a long time ago, and we've just kept with it. It's sort of like a talent show. And I think it is certainly permissible within the realm of the various formats to have it like a talent show, where each candidate gets an opportunity to say what he or she wants to say, and there really isn't much exchange. There can't be much exchange among the various candidates who are on the stage. There are just too many of them.
Mm-hmm. We're going to continue our conversation about presidential primary debates. In this case, this year, once again, it will be among they will occur between. A large stable of candidates, maybe as many as 18 or 19. My guest, John Sides, he's a political scientist at George Washington University and also Ohio State University political scientist Paul Beck in the studio. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. Another crowded Republican presidential primary is upon us. A schedule of at least 9 debates kicks off in Cleveland in August. We've been discussing the logistics of staging a large field of candidates in the debates and also the strategies behind the candidates. Earlier, we recalled the gaffe by then Texas Governor Rick Perry in 2012 when he lost track of his message. In another example, Mitt Romney attracted attention but appeared a little harmed for an exchange with Perry during the 15th GOP debate at St. Anselm College in New Hampshire.
I'll tell you what. $10,000? $10,000 bet?
I'm not in the betting business, but I'll show you.
Yeah. Still with us by phone is George Washington University political scientist John Sides, co-author of the book The Gamble, Choice and Chance in the 2012 Presidential Election. And in the studio with me, OSU political scientist Paul Beck. Now, that exchange had a lot of people shaking their heads because it showed Romney as somebody who can talk about $10,000 bets, let alone a $10 bet. But John Sides, it didn't. Obviously, he became the nominee. It didn't ultimately affect anything.
No, at that point, I mean, he was, I think, becoming relatively secure. The process that Paul described earlier where, you know, the winnowing out of candidates had taken place to a considerable extent, and even the challenges that Gingrich and Santorum were able to mount in early 2012 really, you know, it's clear we're not going to materialize. I think people look at that event and they wonder if this is, you know, this was part of Romney kind of confirming this impression of him as being a wealthy guy that's not really in touch with the concerns of the average voter. You know, we were able to measure people's assessments of Romney on that dimension in our book about the 2012 election. What was fascinating to us is that when we started asking questions about whether, you know, Romney cares about people like you, whether he cares about the middle class, whether he cares about the wealthy, we asked those questions very early in January of 2012 and continuing all the way through the election day. And people's perceptions of Romney just didn't change very much during that time. So I'm not sure that Romney dug himself any deeper with comments like that. On the other hand, if the goal of his campaign was to sort of alter that perception of him, then certainly comments like that probably didn't go a long way towards helping him.
Mm-hmm. I mean, Paul Beck, when you're planning and strategizing for debates like this, these kinds of public appearances, do you think people who were working with Romney were saying, and by the way, you've got to think about your image? How much do they talk about generalities like that versus preparing sound bites?
Well, I'm sure they do talk about that. There are things that they want their candidates to avoid. The problem is, of course, in 2012, there were so many debates they couldn't really adequately prepare anybody for what it was, 27 or at least over 20 debates. And even 12 or 9 is difficult because they're doing other things as well. And it really is the case, and you see this on the campaign trail if you're a reporter following the candidates. They have sort of their stock speech, and it's almost like you push a button and you get that response, and you get that response over and over and over again. Now, if you can knock them off that response, sometimes they will say things that they regret having said that kind of come back to haunt them. But typically, they're giving you the soundbite they've been trained to give.
I heard an interesting tidbit on NPR this morning. Actually, it was Marketplace, and they were talking Marketplace Tech, and they were talking about the impact of technology on the process of these kinds of things. They said during the old-fashioned whistle-stop tours that politicians used to take on trains going across country, they could say different. They could contradict themselves from stop to stop. They can't do that anymore. You really have to stay on message, right, John Sides?
Yeah, I think there's no, you know, there's just a lot of risk in being unscripted, and you know, in some sense, we should expect candidates to hone a message and to repeat that message for a couple of reasons. One, if you know, it's because it's something that they developed and they think is effective, and it's probably more reliable to give that than it is to make up something off the top of your head. And the second thing is, you know, when they go and they're doing this kind of whistle stop, you know, around the diners of Iowa or Manchester, New Hampshire, or wherever, you know, they're talking to voters that haven't heard that speech before.
Right.
The reporters have, and they're bored, and they're just sitting there tapping on their phones. But you know, for voters, it makes sense that if you're speaking to a group of people that, you know, for the first time, you should say what you want to say. And in general, it's a completely boring thing for candidates to do, but it's a completely rational thing for them to do.
Mm-hmm. We have an email from Kelly who says, as so-called debate rules can often reflect some kind of fear of the format, why isn't the RNC more favorable toward candidates asking questions of one another as a rule rather than the exception? Paul Beck?
Well, I think the RNC is gun-shy on this. They don't want to be held responsible for things that don't work out particularly well. That's why they are deferring to the networks or to the sponsors of the debates, although I really imagine that there will be a conversation between the sponsors of the debates and the RNC about what's going to go and what is not going to go. But the RNC would like to have its hands off because it's got up to 20 candidates to deal with, all of whom are important Republicans in one way or another. They don't want to alienate any of them. They certainly don't want to alienate voters who support them. And so they've got this issue they have to deal with, and it's much better to try to keep your hands off most things.
Yeah.
That format is probably one of the riskiest formats they could go for, right? Because if you're going to allow candidates to ask questions of each other, then you're going to allow a candidate to frame a question in a particular way, right, that's really designed to antagonize or criticize a particular candidate. You know, you'll get some version of, when did you stop beating your wife, you know? You will nevertheless, I'm sure, when you get all those candidates on the stage and they start taking shots at each other occasionally, you'll get, you know, some exchanges that will, if not approximating like, you know, our, I don't know, ideals of debates like Lincoln Douglas or something like that, nevertheless will reflect an exchange of some kind. But allowing candidates to sort of ask the questions is a particularly challenging thing from the standpoint of a candidate who would prefer to define the questions that he gets asked or she
right.
gets asked.
In a primary, particularly when, again, as Paul Beck said, all of them are important Republicans in one way or another.
Yep.
A tweet from a listener who asks, why not extend the debate length? This is a democracy. All should be heard. And I think that this, what they mean by is we're talking about 90 minutes at the maximum for the debates coming up beginning in Cleveland in August. But we still, a question I wanted to ask you all earlier was, why are the networks doing this anyway? You've made the point, John Sides, that really not that many people listen to it, especially during a primary.
I guess the question is, it's not very many people in the grand scheme, but how many people is it relative to what you could typically expect on a nightly broadcast on that network?
Okay.
You know, the cable news audience is not massive, right? It's still an audience primarily of politically interested people, and it may be the case that typical relative to the regularly scheduled programming, a primary debate would be kind of an interesting and potentially, you know, newsworthy event, and certainly the networks will do their best to hype it.
But as far as the length, do you see them donating that much more time?
I doubt it. Again, I think that if from the perspective of the underdogs, they would like to have as much time as they possibly could. Mm-hmm. Just gives them more time to make an impression. From the standpoint of the frontrunners, they probably don't want that. And then from the standpoint of the party, I mean, if they view this as an exercise, you know, particularly with the experience of 2012 in their minds, as an exercise in, you know, how can we do this but yet limit the damage, then again, you'd like to keep, you know, the format long enough to be, you know, a real event, but short enough that you're not going to necessarily give lots and lots of time for people to attack each other or otherwise, by the RNC's view, damage the party in some way.
And I think we have to have some sympathy for the poor candidates. This is a really grueling event for them to stand up there for 90 minutes, if that's what it's going to be, and have to be quick on your feet, stave off any kind of damage, engage in some sound bites that are going to give you an advantage. I would guess after 90 minutes they are retreating to their rooms exhausted from this. And if we were to go on for 2 or 3 hours, if they were to do the Lincoln Douglas thing, we might find out a lot in the process, but we also might find some candidates who just say, I can't do this anymore.
John Sides, would it matter if there were no debates?
I guess matter for whom would be the question to ask. It would certainly matter for the news media because they would have less to talk about, less to cover. It would matter to candidates who feel that the debates are, you know, their kind of best shot at making an impact. I don't know that the average voter is going to lose a lot of sleep about it, to be honest. But I think that, you know, it's a tradition in our political process, and so I think there might be some who would lament that, you know, that there wasn't this kind of opportunity for viewing the candidates.
There wasn't a debate in the general election for governor last time around in Ohio, Paul Beck, and that frustrated a lot of listeners, I know. Of course, you know, public radio listeners are intelligent and engaged and all that kind of stuff. I'm not sure, as John Sides just mentioned, too many people lost sleep over it, but it did bother a lot of people.
I think debates are important as a part of the democratic process. Now, whether 12 debates are necessary or 20 or whatever, you know, that's another matter. But it is an opportunity for ordinary voters to see the candidates unprotected in a way. They're not spinning things, or people aren't spinning things for them. The media is not mediating their messages and pulling parts out of their messages. Again, you know, are they of incredible importance? I think not. But as part of the democratic process, I think they're necessary, and they have a real value.
Do looks matter in a debate anymore, John Sides, or by the time they reach that level, everyone's pretty good-looking and above average intelligence?
I mean, I think yes is the short answer. There's the process selects for candidates that are, you know, better than most. You know, it's not to say that there's not any difference among the candidates and their sort of relative level of, let's just call it professionalism. But for the most part, the process is designed to put pretty good people in that role, which is one of the reasons why it's oftentimes hard to really categorically win or lose any particular debate, or in particular, you know, win or lose a series of debates. You know, even if you have an off night, maybe Obama had an off night in the first debate, but, you know, they typically bounce back because they're competent and they prepare differently or better, and then they're ready for the next one. I mean, in particular, I think the other challenge with regard to looks is that there's lots of other information that's being conveyed in the context of a debate that is more than just physical appearance, and that's particularly true by the time you get to a general election where the candidates are much better known. And there's just a lot of other things that people can rely on in order to form assessments of the candidates.
Age can really come out, age differences, and that seems to matter to voters to a certain extent, Paul Beck.
Well, of course, I remember Ronald Reagan's famous quip about age that really advantaged him, it seems to me. But, yeah, age can come out. How energetic people are. We, after all, are selecting a leader. And there are qualities of leadership that I think sometimes can show in that kind of format that we're just not going to be able to get much of a glimpse of through any other format.
You know, John Sides, when you were talking about other information that people get from debates, you're talking about nonverbal communication, those kind of things, whether somebody rolls their eyes or seems dismissive of the other candidates, that sort of thing?
I was more thinking about substantive remarks, positions that they might take.
Okay.
But more generally, I just think about the campaign as providing information through lots of conduits and channels. And so as a consequence, I don't know that a momentary, at a presidential level, a momentary glance of a candidate in a debate and look whether it's their physical appearance or their nonverbal communication or what have you, is really going to be necessarily consequential to voters. I mean, I guess the only real risk that you have as a candidate in that context is, is your behavior or your comportment judged to be negative and newsworthy such that the next, 24, 48 hours or a week of news coverage of you continues to return to that over and over again, like with George H.W. Bush looking at his watch in that debate, that kind of stuff. So it's not, even with Romney, think about the convention, right? And the whole Clint Eastwood with the chair thing.
Oh, boy.
Right? So that's not the ideal conversation you want to be having. But at the end of the day, there are other kind of fundamental factors which are pushing elections towards their outcome. In the presidential general election, certainly voters' partisanship, the broader state of the country and the economy, and, all of these little details that might emerge in a debate, like what color someone's tie was or what have you, probably take a substantial back seat to the bigger drivers.
So I want to ask you, too, before we go, what do you think the process should be or could be for figuring out who's going to participate in these debates going forward? Paul Beck?
Well, I think it's a real dilemma for both the party, the Republican National Committee, or the network sponsors. You could use polls, although what you have to do with the polls is differentiate among those people kind of in the bottom tier who are getting 1.5% of the national public supporting them versus 1.4%.
Yeah.
And how you do that is problematic. One thing that's talked about is to base it on how much money they've raised, which is a test of seriousness of candidacy. That, however, allows individual millionaires to buy their candidate into a debate. Donald Trump is a good example. If he wants to be in the debate, he just writes a check, and all of a sudden he qualifies. So there's no easy answer to that. It gets easier once you've had some caucuses and primaries. But in 2015, at the early stage, you almost are flipping coins among various criteria. And it's far better, I think, for the RNC to say, we'll let the sponsor decide.
Fine for them. But what about you, John Sides?
I don't know what the right rule is. I mean, to me, to be honest, I think it's easier just to say if you're a declared candidate with a campaign committee, it's easier just to put you in there, even though that makes it relatively crowded. Otherwise, what's the right rule? I think Paul's right. Money's an imperfect indicator. You can take polls. That's what they sometimes use in the general election. But at the same time, there are going to be candidates that the party would like to have on the stage for other reasons, like you were talking about with Eli, and they're not going to meet a polling threshold probably. So it seems to me like from the perspective of the party, you're weighing, what's the impact, potential impact if we have this really crowded stage with maybe a couple of candidates that aren't really serious candidates.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, what's the impact if we come up with a rule that excludes certain candidates and that becomes the story
mm-hmm.
that the news media wants to talk about? And so from the perspective of the party, they like to avoid that. I mean, maybe for me, that would mean the easiest rule is just to take all the candidates and let the chips fall where they may. But then again, I'm not in charge of running a political party, so I'm not sure my view should have much credibility here.
But we care. John Sides, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
John Sides, he's George Washington University political scientist and co-author of The Gamble, Choice and Chance in the 2012 Presidential Election. Paul Beck, as always, thanks for your help.
Thank you.
Paul Beck, Ohio State University political scientist. Thanks to the All Sides staff, producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurevich, assistant producer Rachel Quimby. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.